You're listening to Angophora Arts, a podcast about reading
and writing
for people who love books.
This episode was recorded on Gadigal and Bidjigal lands of the Eora Nation. Hello, book world, and welcome to the Angophora Arts podcast. My name is Sarah Sasson. I'm a Sydney-based author, doctor, and researcher, and I'll be your host. Every week, we'll be chatting to local authors and other members of the literary community. So let's see who we'll be catching up with this week. Kate Goldsworthy is an editor who's been working on trade books since 2010. She has a diploma in professional writing and editing from RMIT. And as a freelance editor, she's worked for Allen & Unwin, Penguin Random House, HarperCollins, Hachette, Affirm Press, Text Publishing, and many more. I first met Kate when I cold called her through the Freelance Editors Network to help with a structural edit on my debut novel manuscript, which would later become Tidelines. I enjoyed working with Kate so much that we worked together again when she did the copy editing for Signs of Life, the Medical Humanities Anthology.
Hi, I'm going well, thanks. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us today. So you're joining us from Victoria, is that right?
That's right. I live in the Dandenong Ranges, just in the foothills, not really up high on the hill. And we've been here for about 6 years now. And we've got the cat, the chickens, and a 1.5-year-old. It's a great lifestyle out here.
I have to admit, I haven't been to the Dandenong Ranges, but I really like the word Dandenong for a start. So I think it's really cool. Your life there does sound, quite wonderful and idyllic and very conducive to reading. How is this week going? Has this week been filled with a lot of book-related things, or has it been a less bookish time?
My weeks, especially since having a kid with my wife, are pretty – I don't really have a very strict schedule. Maybe it would be better if I did. But
I'm a scheduling person, so you're terrifying me now.
I think that, especially when you're living on toddler time, sometimes it can be good to go with the flow. And sometimes things go wrong out here. Like, I'm a little bit delayed because we suddenly ran out of water in our water tank. So we, had to go and pick up a lot of water from the supermarket. And, it's really wonderful out here, but it's a semi-rural lifestyle. So sometimes things don't go well.
I'm curious, when did you decide on a career, on your editing career? And what was the path that led you to where you are today?
Yeah, well, obviously I was always really loved reading, and I also got into creative writing when I was a teenager. I wrote a fantasy novel as a teenager, and I spent a lot of time thinking about it and trying to work it out and reading it back to myself on tape. And my dad was, he basically is never going to retire, but he was a law professor at Monash, and he helped me look at my work and kind of did basic copy editing things and gave me some advice. And then I had a part scholarship to a really good private school, and we went to a lit camp. So, there was a lot of encouragement to write, and there was nothing really holding me back from doing that in my spare time. And I was very nerdy, and I still am. So, I'd stay up late writing and watching Buffy and watching The X-Files. So getting into speculative stuff and reading a whole different range of books without ever really being that, not really discriminating against different genres. I always tried to keep an open mind and don't really, hate a particular genre the way that some people do. That would make my work pretty difficult.
Did you actually finish a novel as a teenager? Did you write it to complete?
I did, but, I don't actually know how many words it was. Was it really a novel? It was long. I think it was novel length. At the time I wouldn't have known what a sort of standard novel length was, and I did submit it to Penguin and got a nice rejection letter. I think by that stage though I'd realised that this probably wasn't going to be something I wouldn't pursue this particular novel. I wrote it when I was 14. Yeah. And I wrote fan fiction as well. I wrote quite a lot of fan fiction and put that online, and I had an audience for that That's just like stories about, you know, whatever particular TV show you happen to like. And I think at the time that was quite like very niche interest, but it's become, I think, a lot more popular. And even now there are fan fiction books that have been published as novels with like the characters, mm-hmm. like 50 Shades of Grey used to be a fanfic. And they, yeah, you didn't know that side of things. Yeah.
I wanted to go back to when you said, I think you're saying as a teenager you read quite non-discriminatory across different genres, and I can relate to that as well. And it's funny having my own children, how when we start as readers, yeah, we haven't defined our taste really, and we're sort of looking what's out there. Yeah. And then I think in adulthood we sort of, yeah, put ourselves in boxes a little bit, or we decide what we like and we don't like. But there's something very wonderful and beautiful and open-minded about just picking books off the shelves because you like the look of the cover or the spine without really having all these preconceived ideas of what you should be reading.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not sure if I was doing that exactly. It was more like exploring the different areas, you know, crime fiction, horror, mm-hmm. Fantasy, sci-fi. I mean, I'm sure there were people who were bigger readers than me. But I was reading fan fiction as well. I think that's an interesting thing, because it's like when you're reading that kind of, well, I guess you'd call it amateur work, you know, it's not professionally published, professionally edited. Start to find like, what is it this author's trying to communicate, and what are they kind of trying to get across here, you know, and does it appeal to me? Or, you know, everyone is writing for some sort of purpose. Unless they're just using ChatGPT, which is a different thing. Everyone's trying to get across something or to explore something, and maybe the writing can be clumsy or it's not quite, you know, doing what they want it to do, but there's something in there that's kind of golden that they're wanting to communicate.
Sometimes, yeah, the idea there's an idea about something that's very powerful, even if the mechanism by which it's portrayed, you know, isn't high.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it's like, well, how could this be conveyed in a way that like is going to be understood by more people or appeal to more people or get across what the author wants in the best way for them?
But I'm interested in that crossover between written literature and and like television or movies, because and this conversation that opens up between them. And so I wrote a lot of my novel on maternity leave, and for one reason or the other, I got very into Breaking Bad, which I don't know, it's like this drama.
I haven't actually watched Breaking Bad. As I got older, it's not that I don't like the genre, but in my personal time, I don't tend to watch a lot of like horror related things anymore. I just overdosed on that a little bit.
I remember watching it with my newborn, and like at times just sort of like turning my newborn's face away. It's just like, you know, I'm pretty sure my child couldn't even focus on the television at the point, but like just nothing was going into the back of their retina. But
I know what you mean.
The writing was excellent, and that show taught me about sort of foreshadowing, because the way the writers on that show, I've been to a couple of talks about the show afterwards, but they would, because it went for something like 6 seasons, but they never knew how many seasons they'd be funded for. And yet the whole thing is this amazing, almost perfect narrative arc.
That's so rare. Yeah. I know about Breaking Bad a little bit because I think the guy who created it or did most of the writing, Vince Gilligan, he started out on The X-Files, and he actually wrote some of the X-Files episodes that I liked the most, really good ones. So I think he got his start there, and then he moved on to Breaking Bad. So, you know.
I just learned so much from that show, screenwriters and how they would, sort of drop clues at the beginning, and you'd hold on to them wondering what those symbols were, what they meant, and then later it would all come to fruition.
It's magical when that happens, isn't it? It's such a great feeling. And I think sometimes, you know, you can see what someone's trying to achieve that, and you can see the steps they're taking towards that. And maybe as an editor, you can kind of, in a structural edit, help them, you know, stick the landing the way they want to. Mm-hmm. You can talk it through and kind of help guide them towards that. And then if it clicks, you can see the author's excitement and hear how happy they are that this has worked out the way they wanted it to, but it's hard when you're so close to it. And TV shows, I'm sure, are very collaborative. They have like a writer's room and they have editors and they have lots of different people working on the show. That really appeals to me. And I think, you know, publishing is actually quite a lot like that, but it's a lot of it's behind the scenes. So, you know, there's that idea of the genius writer being alone and working totally alone. And maybe for some literary authors, it is kind of true. Some of the books I work on for Transit Lounge might be by someone who's, you know, really quite obsessive and they've worked on it for about 10 years and it's very literary and it's like there's actually not a huge amount that you do. You're like copy editing it and picking out little details, but like they have a particular vision. Maybe they've workshopped it. They've spent maybe hours and hours and hours thinking it through. And then maybe you're working on a book by, you know, and some commercial authors would probably do that too. Some people, there's a bit of pressure on them. It's like, you know, you need to write a new crime novel every year, or you need to, you know, you're a commercial author, you're writing quite regularly. And then I think there's maybe a bit more collaboration and help because it's like, well, there's a bigger budget maybe. And also there's like not as much time and, you know, you don't have 10 years to write the next crime novel in the series.
Fans are waving. Yeah, that's what I found. My novel, especially when you're a debut, I mean, I wrote so much, you know, like probably 95% of it was just me at a desk, you know, very solitary. But then once you get picked up by the publisher, all of a sudden there is a little team around it. And it's sort of, it was, I mean, I was ready for it, but I was interested that it became this communal object then. And a common refrain in my editing was, look, you know, this section or this line or this phrase is obviously, you know, it's resonant to you, but it's not resonating for, you know, others. And, you know, so I was trying to say something, you know, very meaningful, and it had meaning to me, but, yeah, it was getting lost in translation to the wider audience. So and I thought that was interesting to think about, and that's why you need the sounding board of the publishers and the editors saying, you know, this isn't landing, what are you trying to say and how can we say it so that it reaches me?
What are you trying to communicate, because that's how it's coming across to me. And I think actually that's kind of what led me towards, in the end, like choosing to become an editor, because at uni, I did a double degree when you could do a double degree at Melbourne Uni. And I did, I majored in psychology and science, and I ended up majoring in literature and arts. But I kind of thought, well, it's interesting to me, but is this actually going somewhere? Like, am I actually going to become an editor and do that? And, you know, a lot of people will say things like, oh, you'll just end up editing computer manuals, you know, things like that. That it's like, is that something you think? It's not like the easiest industry and it's not like the highest paid or anything. So, you know, like becoming a psychologist is probably more profitable and with more job security. People obviously need psychologists, right? So I ended up going on exchange to San Diego in California for several months. And while I was there, I was asked to be the teaching assistant, like free, of course. There's a lot of like free teaching assistants and internships. Things you do in America. But as the philosophy of the creative writing course was to really ask, well, what does the author want to communicate and what is the reader taking in? And so as the leading these workshops, I had to, we all needed to express, well, what is it we got out of the story? And the author would be like, oh, that wasn't what I was trying to get across at all, or I wasn't meaning for that line to be funny, or, you know, sometimes I felt like it could be a difficult conversation. I don't know if I always handled it well because I was only just starting out. But the idea was to be, like, generous with feedback but also, like, honest and, try and help them achieve what they wanted to achieve. And then I did an internship at a lesbian magazine in San Francisco called Curve, that was like a print magazine at the time. Makes me feel old. and then that was a lot of like proofreading and copy editing type stuff, and I realized I could sit there and just kind of do it and concentrate on that. I thought, well, when I finished, I had about a year to go of my undergraduate degree, and I thought, well, when I finish that, maybe that's what I will do. And then I got into the professional writing and editing course at RMIT, which is a really fantastic course. And through that did, you know, various subjects to do with novel writing and young adult and editing. And then through the course, I met people in the industry. So the course was really, really helpful. That was how I made my connection at Allen and Unwin. There was someone who came to talk and I said, can I do some proofreading for you? So, and that ended up being, you know, I still work for Allen and Unwin now as a freelancer. I've been working for them for about 15 years. You know, not when I was working in-house at a firm, but otherwise I've been working with them.
So, yeah, as I said before, I approached you working on a sort of small, independent grassroots project, but then we worked together again when I was pipeline. So most of the work that you do, is it manuscripts on query from people who are unpublished, or is most of your work contracted work from traditional publishing houses, or is it a mix?
I haven't actually looked. I'd say most of it is from traditional publishing houses in terms of hours worked, because most of the copy editing work I do, which is the most time consuming work, I think, you know, most of the time it's the most time consuming work, can spend, you know, I don't know if I've done more than this, but I've spent more than 100 hours copy editing a manuscript before, you know, like it can be very, very full on. I'd say on average it's probably half of that. And depending on the word count and and you would have gone through that copy editing process too with Tyler. Mm. So, you know, it's quite time consuming and picky. Whereas a structural edit, and I do structural edits for publishing companies as well. And then there's manuscript assessments. I'm a manuscript assessor with Kill Your Darlings. And I'm also do private assessments, or sometimes that's just reading the manuscript, taking notes and just having a phone chat with the author, or sending them some notes by email, you know, depending on what the author's looking for.
Like, I was so grateful to connect with you so early in my career, and I remember, having such a good experience on both books. But then I started, in all the Australian literature I read, I started flicking to the back, and then I noticed your name in so many of the acknowledgement sections, and I was like, wow, that really works on a lot of books. I was just sort of like blown away when your name came up in the books I was reading.
That's lovely that you saw my name there, and I'm really always really grateful when authors mention me in the acknowledgements. It's really lovely when they do that.
Maybe no one's going to work on my small indie book, but it was just sort of like, made me feel good that someone of your stature was also working on, more grassroots projects.
I wouldn't discriminate against different projects, and I'm happy to work with indie authors, although I don't often do that. I guess because I have these relationships with publishers and they ask me to do work for them, so I just, book them in advance. But I am going to work with an indie author soon. I think I said this to you when you were publishing Signs of Life, that I wouldn't usually, this is just my personal thing, but I don't usually do a copy edit for a private client. If they are determined to self-publish and they have the budget to pay for a copy edit, then that's fine. So that's why I worked on your book. Mm-hmm. I copy edited that. A lot of the time, though, it's like, well, if an author really wants a copy edit, really, and they understand the fact that it will be copy edited and probably structurally edited again when it's published, then maybe I would do it. But, I just wonder about like them spending that amount of money on something when it will be done again if they do get a publishing contract with a traditional publisher.
Because I did all the structural editing for Signs of Life, but I just, I'm not trained in copy editing, and I just didn't want to, I wanted that book to, just be of the highest quality it could be.
And I really respect that, and I think like you could afford it, and also it wasn't the kind of book where you were going to find a traditional publisher for it. I don't think like that would have been
complete like unknown, like, you know, I hadn't published anything, and it was sort of it was medical humanities, it was international flavor, but it was so important to me, and the messages of it important. So I had zero hesitations about paying for a copy edit.
There are projects where there are many examples of projects where an Australian publisher is probably not going to pick it up, and yet does that mean that it's somehow not worthy or it's not worth something. That's not true, you know. I mean, you're speaking to someone who like grew up reading fan fiction. I don't think there's anything wrong with people putting their own art out into the world if they can afford it and understand the risks. And it's like in that case, it's not just, you know, it's a collection of pieces by all these different people who want to communicate something about medicine and health. And, you know, I can think of another example. I worked on a book by someone who wanted to make a coffee table book about the Great Ocean Road. And it was very specific to that area and also involved geology. It's a beautiful book. And she ended up going ahead with it and making this very beautiful book. But it wasn't something where, like, you were going to get a huge amount of sales Australia-wide, you know what I mean? I would encourage any author to think outside the box and think, you know, maybe I don't have to get a traditional publisher. If you've been rejected by every traditional publisher, does that mean that your book has to sit in a drawer forever and no one can ever read it? Or is that like, oh, you know, I mean, if you make the decision then and think, okay, you know what, this isn't the book that I want to put out in the world, that's different. But if you've written something or you want to, you know, create a book project and it's not something that's going to be picked up, then, yeah, why not do it yourself?
Yeah, I think, and now having been traditionally published and understanding how risky the whole thing is and, you know, how, you know, and it is like then publishers get sent so many manuscripts and they've got to make decisions and, of course, they have to look at what people are likely going to buy or who it's going to appeal to. All that grassroots indie projects is also a value, but and it also it's a training ground, it's a free expression. You know, art doesn't just appear perfectly formed, you know. It all comes from somewhere. And I think, well, for me, that project was so it made me feel like it validated me as a writer. It also connected me to a community of other emerging writers, many who have went on to be traditionally published. Like Al Campbell, Annette Freeman and Sophie Overett were all contributors to Signs of Life. So it's been really exciting to watch their careers build. And, yeah, it also just showed me how many emerging writers, I sensed that the talent pool of emerging writers was very wide and deep. And then by putting that call out, it just sort of, yeah, it sort of made it visible to me how many people were out there writing and trying to get published. And I think you don't see that normally in the industry. You see, you know, the debut novelists and the second book novelists and the well-established, but, you know, beneath all that, beneath the meniscus of all that is all these other people writing and trying to get published. And also that's something that people celebrated and encouraged because we want to live in a culture where people are having ideas and original thoughts.
Exactly. And it's and with the way that information can be shared now, there's nothing holding you back from sharing what you've created. And with, you know, the rise of these AI machines to just sort of write things for us, it's maybe even more important to share our own art and communicate as human beings and then protect your work as much as possible. I guess I don't really know how to do that now, but it's an interesting kind of, it's like more than ever we can share our work with each other and then there's just so much of it. It's impossible for anyone to read every book that's published just within a month or maybe even a week, probably. And, like, how many books can you read in the span of a lifetime? And when you're working on books like I am, I don't even read as much for pleasure anymore because, you know, that can be hard to go from working on a book and then reading a book and then reading articles online and just reading constantly. You have to have a brain break sometime, right? It can be good to look out here, go for a nice long walk in the bush or something like that.
Yeah, I know. It's like drinking from a fire hydrant the whole time.
So much information. But that doesn't mean that, you know, because it's like whatever you've written or whatever you've created, there probably is some audience for it. It might be a million people or it might be 10 people. But imagine, you know, you've written something and there are 10 people in the room who just love it and you're reading it out to them from a podium and they are just crying or they're laughing or they're, you know, isn't that satisfying in itself? Does it have to be a million people? Does it have to be 10 million? You know, like getting any readers for your book is pretty great.
Mm. it's a good example. I was very close to my dad's mother, my nana, and her sister wrote, and she self-published basically like a fictionalized story of her life. And it's sort of like the family history, you know, and she self-published it, and, you know, and I found it the other day and started reading it. But I was like, you know, this was never going to be a book for the masses, but how special to have like an own account, like within the family of a
family. Exactly. Like imagine, like I did a bit of family history research during the pandemic just because, you know.
What else was there to do?
I was working on a book where the author had used Trove quite a lot for research, and I thought, oh, I'll use Trove and look up family. And, you know, I found out things like one of my great-great-grandfathers or something wrote a piece about Shakespeare for a Shakespeare club. And I was like, if only I could read that. If only I could read his weird essay about Shakespeare. He was a Shakespeare conspiracy theorist. He thought Shakespeare was secretly Scottish.
Oh.
You know what? I get that. You know, I don't believe Shakespeare was secretly Scottish, but I get you. You were a crazy fanboy and you were obsessed with Shakespeare, and I understand that personally. But that piece is lost forever now, so that's kind of frustrating.
Because no Tumblr back then, like
exactly. If only I could go on Tumblr and read his long, you know, screed about it. I'm sure everyone else in his Shakespeare cup. I'm like, yeah, sure, okay, yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna ask you another question. So you probably see a lot of new and emerging writers. What are some common mistakes you see them making, and like is there any advice you'll give them when people are trying to crack into the industry?
Yeah, well, it depends. Like I was just thinking about just based on what we've been talking about, you know, the book as an art object versus a commercial object. But it depends what you mean by a mistake as well. I think it's good during the writing process, maybe for a lot of people just to focus on the writing and not think about it as a commercial object. But once you're looking for a publisher, you do have to remember that it's an industry. We live in capitalism. It's a capitalist industry. People are trying to make a profit and they need to. And that's not mean. They actually need to pay their employees and who are, you know, quite often not paid a huge amount anyway. People are running on a tight budget and they're working crazy hours sometimes, and there's a lot of books to read, a lot of submissions, a lot to sort through. Submissions coming from agents, submissions coming from the slush pile, manuscript competitions, events to do. There's just so much going on. Books to send to print, authors who are having a breakdown, authors who are happy but want to do a lot of publicity. There's just so much happening, and it's like you need revenue, you need to have, and then, you know, since the pandemic, there's been issues with like supply chain and, you know, the cost of printing. So keeping all that in mind, maybe when you're sending your book out, thinking, you know, I'm taking my personal project that I love so much and I want other people to read it, and I also probably want them in most cases to make some sort to, they're going to have to benefit from it somehow. Probably the publishing house wants to benefit from your book somehow.
So do you think that tension between you sort of said it like, is this an art object, is it a commercial object? And I think, yeah, that's so hard, and some people clearly identify as, you know, genre writers, or, you know, they're you know, they're thinking about the market and the trends and what's happening. And then there's probably other subgroups of writers who are just, you know, to quote Charlotte Wood, in the wormhole of fascination. And are there some perfectly in the middle? I think, yeah, I guess from my point of view, like I was very interested in creating an art object, but then I really didn't want, well, yeah, I was interested in how it was going to become commercialized. And I had a very positive experience at a firm, but my greatest fear was that my book was going to get sort of like mushed up and like turned into something it wasn't, which didn't happen, and I was very happy.
No, I was terrified
yeah. For the process.
But you do have to definitely, maybe that's kind of what you do have to think about, like how far are you going to go? You know, you turned, I won't because it's private, but like when I first saw your book, it's quite different from what was eventually published. You were wanting to achieve certain things that didn't need it to be written in the original way. you could achieve them having it in a different way. Not everyone, ultimately at the end of the day, you know, like it's your commercial, like it's your name on the cover and you'll be the one with the book on your shelf for the rest of your life probably. So, you know, and you're the one who'll be known as the author and people will identify that work with you. Is this really the book you want to be your book?
It must be something really, like it must be a feeling no one wants that, yeah, if you put out a book, but, yeah, I guess ultimately, yeah, you feel like it's not a true reflection of what you wanted or who you are.
Or maybe that works. Like maybe you're thinking, look, I can't change it. It has to be like this. But actually it's possible to change it and still achieve what you wanted and find a bigger readership.
Yeah, I think just for the listeners, what Kate's alluding to is in my first drafts of Tidelines, it was far more experimental. I was very interested in sort of the idea of found poetry, and so I sort of had different texts inserted. I actually realized later what I was trying to do was write a bit like Jenny Offal, who wrote Weather and Department of Speculation. But the issue was I hadn't read any Jenny Offal yet. And so later I read her and I was like, I think that's what I was trying to do. But she does it in a much more masterful way. When Affirm picked up the book, I can't remember how much. I had edited a lot of it out already. It was already far more traditional. And they just sort of explained that, you know, commonly with new writers, you know, readers don't always want to take big risks with them, and it was better to sort of try and walk a little bit more traditional to get people on board and, yeah, not confuse people. But really the heart of my novel was about, you know, ideas and human relationships and all that could be done with a more traditional kind of structure, which was really it was an elliptical structure with part one and part two. But then the bits I sort of fought for were, certain pieces of poetry which I just absolutely couldn't dispose of, and I sort of managed to work them into various dialogue scenes or like my favourite kind of phrase.
Come up against this and found a way that works for you. And you went with a publisher that was a bit more commercial. There might have been another publisher out there who was willing to just say, you know what, let's just publish it exactly as it is and we'll just see what happens. And you just don't know exactly, like a different publisher, your book will end up different depending on who edits it and who you work with and which publisher picks it up. And that's just part of it. So that original draft will always be there and it's not going anywhere, and you know you can hold on to it forever. And then there's also going, if you do get picked up by a publisher, then there will be another version that's been professionally edited and potentially changed, partly based on, you know, wanting more to reach a wider readership. Or you know, there could be a focus. It's hard to focus on like winning a literary award. It's like, how can you edit a book to win a literary award? I don't think that's really possible. You edit it as well as you possibly can so that there are like as few mistakes as possible, and it's, you know, the ideas are conveyed in the way that feels as authentic and just kind of hope for the best, right? It is kind of a lottery, isn't it, winning an award? But that's a different kind of.
All the other books that are coming out that
dependent on that, dependent on the judges, their particular, you know, like it's a, whenever you're being published or assessed, that's a group of humans who are doing it. We haven't reached AI judgment of manuscripts yet. Imagine like the Stella Prize AI version. So, you know, these judges change from year to year and they have different things they're looking for. So, you know, so much of that is just like the luck of the draw. And then imagine how many books are published even just in Australia alone, and you have to narrow it down to some small group and then pick one out of that brilliantly written group. So going back to talking about mistakes people make, then there are like editorial mistakes, and I think that's possibly more what you were asking about. I was going to add like another thing about approaching the industry is if you're writing memoir, if you're writing something personal, you have to realize that potentially family members and friends and people you know, people you've worked with are going to read those books. And like, that sounds kind of obvious, but it's amazing how so many people just haven't really thought of that or processed that. They've got a publishing contract and then they're like, oh, wait.
Actually, it's going to be some fallout from this. Yeah.
This could potentially be fallout for the rest of my life. There could potentially be someone playing me in a movie. You know, that's unlikely, but possible. You do have to maybe think about that too. When it comes to like editorial stuff, I'd say the number one thing is timelines. Mm-hmm. Timelines. And I say that every time I'm talking about and I've done but I did an online workshop thing for Kill Your Darlings about preparing your manuscript for publication, but just like there are all kinds of things you can maybe do yourself to make your manuscript more appealing to publishers, and one of them could be to just write a separate timeline document with dot points about, it could be based on a calendar year. If you've written a novel or if you've written a memoir, you don't actually necessarily remember things in the order they happened. Mm-hmm. Possibly it didn't happen at the same time as that historical event. That's a light bulb memory and it's not real. And you need to actually maybe, you see, I sense a little bit of frustration in my voice.
It just starts not making sense. It gets jumbled somewhere.
It can be a huge amount of time for the editor and the publisher to like kind of sort through it. Like, you know, if the pregnancy is going for 12 months, or like if the sun steps like pregnancy, you're not living on that Star Wars planet where there are two suns. I think I've said that.
It's funny you're talking about how tedious copy editing was before. I love a copy edit, but it's a structural edit that scares me, and it scares me because of the timelines, because I usually have everything bedded down and I'm really happy with the timeline. And then people say, and then I'm like, because we're going to introduce mistakes.
No, but you're someone who has schedules and you're an organized kind of person. That's actually quite different from a lot of authors. So like, imagine you're the kind of author who's just kind of written it all out. And then I say, but these two things can't happen on the same day. Or like, you know, you've got one character off doing this and you've got another character off doing this, and then they meet up again. Well, it's not possible because of one character was doing something over like 6 months and the other one was doing something over 2 days. Now they can't meet. And then the author will be like, oh, yeah, didn't really think about that because I was caught up in the creative process, man. You know, I was going with the flow and then... Yeah, but unfortunately, you do have to obey the laws of physics most of the time.
I got really obsessed with birthdays. Like often it comes up like, you know, someone's birthday, but I was like, well, you really have to keep an eye on that, you know, someone's not having two birthdays in 1 year, or that they go from like a summer to a winter birthday.
It could be like, you know, it's 6 o'clock at night, but it's the middle of the night, but it's the middle of summer.
They've got the fire on.
No, it's like it's daylight savings time.
Okay. Black.
It's an atmospheric scene. It's just that it can't be night.
Yeah, it's not the East Coast of Australia. Look, we are amazingly almost out of time. Because we've had such an awesome conversation, I want to ask two last questions. What's the best thing about being an editor? And what are some literary events or launches that you're excited about coming up for you?
I mean, working with the authors is the best thing about my job. I think it always will be. Everyone's, you know, got their own take, and everyone's just, really trying to say something, and it's meaningful to them. And that's, you know, I love authors and I love working with creative people. It doesn't matter whether it's a super commercial book or a memoir or, you know, true crime, which I've worked on very rarely, or, you know, whatever it is. And they're just, yeah, it's just wonderful. And I just love it when, you know, you give someone advice and it actually helps them. Mm. You know, it makes me feel like I'm working like a tradie.
You know, like, you're the font of wisdom is how I would describe it. Because when I was querying Tideline, you gave me all this. Remember, you gave me all this industry advice because I wasn't having much luck on my query. But I just sort of followed all your advice and look, it worked. So.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad it worked for you. It doesn't always work. I just want to say, like, as a disclaimer, there's no guarantee at all. But, like, yeah, I'm really happy. And I feel like even with copy editing, when you're doing, like, just don't even do that much with some of these, you know, like I worked on this novel by this literary author, Gregory Day, and I think it's just the most, it's just such a beautiful novel. Oh, I said I wasn't going to promote any particular book.
That's all right.
Anyway, but I felt like I didn't do that much, but he was really grateful. And I, you know, even that, it's like one novel, you're cutting 10,000 words or you're completely rearranging it. Another one, maybe you're just pointing out some word repetition and punctuation issues, and both authors will just light up, and that's wonderful. And seeing them at the launches is wonderful. I think that the pandemic was really, really tough because, you know, so many people, the launch is such a big night for them and their book, and it was hard to just do that online. Readings ran some really great online launches, and I know other bookstores did too. But yeah, the launches are great. So speaking of events, that's the main ones that I would go to, are launches for my authors' books. I'm going to go to one soon for Andrea Goldsmith's book is being released this month, and she's wonderful. I
have the title for that one. I'll put it in the show.
Yeah, it's called The Buried Life. It's just such a beautiful literary novel. Talk about an author who doesn't need a huge amount of copy editing. And yeah, no, she was great to work with, and she has a lot of experience. She's had several novels published. And I worked with an author on her second book recently and went to her launch last month. Was it last month? I've completely lost track of the time. That's Mary Rose Coscully, and her book was The Campers, and that's an Ellen and Unwin book. That was wonderful. Very well attended launch in Melbourne at the Emporium.
That looks like such a beautiful space to launch.
It's great. You know, you think that it's in a shopping center, but it's got a big window. It's got windows. It's really laid out well. Yeah. And it's got a lovely little space to do the launches.
Well, we'll put those books in the show notes, and and it's so nice to hear you enjoy working with authors. But yeah, whenever I go to a writer's festival or events, I think the thing about writers is they're also into something. Like,
they're obsessive people.
Into something. And so there's none of this like chit chat, but you start talking about their work or each other's work, and the conversation just kind of explodes because they've just been doing some research, or they've been thinking about something, or they've got an issue with themselves. So I also just love talking to writers because they've always got something interesting to say, or they've done a deep dive on some esoteric thing and have some information to share from it.
Yeah, always learning something new, always experiencing something new, never really knowing what's going to come next. I really love that about my work.
Well, we are out of time, but I just wanted to say, a big thank you for spending time with us today and, sharing some of your stories and insights. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Oh, well, me too. I love talking to you, and all the best with this podcast.